You're listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners. To donate, click on the Canada Helps button or go to westhill.net/donate.
In order to preserve some anonymity here, I'm going to tell you that someone that I sleep with reads to me each night, and recently we began an Ursula Le Guin novel, which we subsequently realized was not a book that you could read out loud. But one of the first sentences in the book said, "I didn't realize that I was in peril," or something like that. And I reached out and touched the individual, who will remain anonymous, and said, "Oh, it's like that moment when you fall in love." Well, that person almost kicked me out of the bed. They couldn't understand what I meant by that. That peril that one is in when one is in those first few moments of falling in love. So I needed to find a reading, and I did, from C.S. Lewis, about how challenging and dangerous falling in love can be. Because, of course, your heart is at risk when you fall in love. You open the door to experiencing emotions you would never know. The greatest of one is often pain. Because when you love, you must be prepared for loss. Because loss will come at some point in time. And so, when you are in that moment of falling in love, you are at great peril. We continue on. For those of you who don't know, I actually live with, sleep with, and am married to the guy who plays the piano. Just want to straighten that out. Just in case my mother's watching. But we're now in our second last of our Academy Awards series, looking at these films, five films which have been nominated for Best Picture, through the lens of communications, seeing what it is that they tell us about communication and how it is that we can learn about ourselves, as we should always do when exposed to great film. And Amour is the movie of the week, a movie that perhaps more than any movie I've ever seen demonstrates exactly the peril at which your heart is that moment that you fall in love. One reviewer suggested that the movie was not really meant for people in the age bracket that's depicted there. The actor, Jean-Louis Trintignant, is 82, and his partner in the movie, Emmanuel Riva, is 85. They're depicting an elderly Parisian couple who live in a somewhat beautiful apartment in Paris, retired after long careers, hers we know as a piano teacher. And they are facing the end of their lives, perhaps unsuspecting at first, but later on recognizing what is happening and facing it with a deep resolve and incredible pain. So the story of Amour we're going to examine, as we have the other stories that we've looked at, the other movies, through that lens of communication and those difficult conversations that we've been looking at. Only this time, rather than just reviewing the difficult conversations premise and then talking about the movie, I'm going to actually look at the movie from those through those particular conversations that are taking place within any difficult conversation. And also looking at it, as I attempt to do with most of the perspectives that I share with you, in terms of our relationships on a global scale, on an interpersonal scale, and within ourselves. Because we speak about wanting to live in right relationship with ourselves, with others, and with the world. So that first conversation that the authors of Difficult Conversations say is taking place when you're having one is that conversation about what happened. And looking at that from a global scale, in a global, our relationships on a global level, we might review what happened in Amur, looking at aging populations, how their care is managed by governments or by those within the household. We watch as Georges and Anne walk a journey that many have walked before. One of the things that surprised me about this movie was that I didn't use the three boxes of Kleenex I had lined up on the couch beside me in expectation of its incredible emotional toll that it would take. The reality is that unless you're young and have just fallen in love or recently been married, if you've hit my age and you've watched aging parents or you've watched friends or you've been exposed to the decrepitude that age often brings with it, what happens in the movie is not shocking or surprising. The producer brings you, the filmmaker brings you that loss and the unraveling of health in an intimate and powerful way. Yet the story is not one that is extraordinary by any stretch. It's a story that's taking place probably in half a dozen places between here and the 401 if you're going up Morningside. It's a story that's taking place in several of your lives. It's a story that has unfolded over and over again. And so on a global scale, if we're going to look at this and say, what happened? We can talk about aging populations, how people have lived longer now than they ever have before. And so our physical bodies, which were really maybe only meant to live till shortly after 21 when apparently we peak, sorry about that, but it's true. If you're only supposed to live till shortly after you're 21, then who cares if your teeth fall out when you're 60? Or who cares if your brain can't manage the blood flow when you're 80? Because you're not going to live much long after 21. But we now live way longer after 21. And so our performance, our bodies that aren't functioning as well as they may, they experience the loss of the capacities that they once had. In a global scale, the question is going to be, into the future, who gets to live longer? Because who gets the technology that allows you to have, as some of you do, new hips or new knees? What allows you to have, what gives you access to the medications that allow you to live longer, that allow me to survive after the many things that would have taken my life if I had been born 20, even maybe 10 years before I was? The technologies that we assume are available to us maybe aren't available in the rest of the world, and maybe as resources dwindle, maybe less and less available. So the ethical conversation around who gets to access these resources will be a real one. But I'm getting off the topic. The question is, on a global scale, who's taking care of whom? Because in the global scale, in terms of this movie, the global scale is the multitude of people who are experiencing this on an interpersonal and personal level. And so we quickly look at what happened in terms of this relationship as we look at our own relationships. And what we see is that perilous moment when two people fell in love and committed themselves to one another, to stay together through thick and through thin. And when that challenge gets on the most treacherous of grounds, when one is ailing in a way that the other, and perhaps both, know is not going to turn around and come back to health again. On that level, that interpersonal level, what happened was two people loved one another right up until the end. And if those of you have you watched the movie? I don't want to give the ending away, but it's difficult not to give it away without talking about the power of it. At the end of this long story of loss, these steps, which one reviewer, I believe it was the Globe and Mail, said started with a violent episode. The violent episode took place at the breakfast table when Anne simply started staring off and not responding to George. No matter what he did, she didn't respond. He called that a violent episode because on a cellular brain level, there was a little explosion going on there, or a little loss. It wasn't an explosion, sorry, it was a stroke. So it was a little blockage happening, meaning that oxygen wasn't getting to the brain and things were happening. So he called that violent, but it was actually a quiet, peaceful moment that took place. And from there on, the number of times and things that happen increases that violence, as the reviewer said, though you don't see much of it until perhaps one brutal episode when George loses his patience with a wife who refuses to eat. And then the shock and horror on his face touches each of us deeply as you watch that film. At the end, however, of the movie, George acts in what is perhaps the most violent way that we humans can think of acting toward another in this life. And yet, it is one of those moments where the power of love transcends even the greatest violence, as that Globe reporter also put it. And so it shines through, amour shines through even that most violent of acts. On a personal level, what is happening in this story? What's happening inside each individual is separate and distinct. We aren't really sure, well into the story, whether Anne really knows what's happening. Early on, she absolutely does, and she's adamant about what she wants to happen and what she doesn't. She's refusing to eat when George loses his temper with her, because she knows that her decline is not turning around, that she will continue to become more and more dependent. And the filmmaker shows us that dependence in graphic ways, reminding us that we too walk this journey, and that it will be a journey toward humility if we don't already have it, that we lose our dignity as we take part in that journey. And Anne does not want to do this, as so many of us do not want to do, but she is taken on that journey unwillingly and unwittingly, we hope, toward the end. George, on the other hand, is watching someone who he loves disappear. And I know many of you have watched that, looking into the eyes of people that you love and watching the person that you know, the person that you love, the person with whom you may have shared all your adult memories, disappear before your eyes. And the loss in John's face is enormous, in George's face is enormous. That's the first difficult conversation. What actually went on, and what's the truth there? And as we can see, on a global level, the truth is very different from the interpersonal level, and even the two individuals in the story are having very, very different stories happening. Very different truths come to the table. Their daughter, Ava, shows up periodically, but she is held at arm's length, even locked out of her mother's room at one point, because her father wants to do this as a nation of two. He wants to do this just with his wife. He doesn't feel that the things that are happening should be seen by others, despite the irony that it is being brought to the grand screen for all of us to see. It's a personal story that he wants to keep that way, the privacy of it held within the bounds of the apartment. It's an interesting piece, though, because you watch George and Anne in this nation of two, as marriage has once been called. In this nation of two, they are tragically and remarkably alone. There's very few who come in to offer them support. Ava, who has her own agenda and tries to foist it upon them, rebuffed by her father regularly and clearly. And a landlord and landlady who come in and help with the groceries, and then staff, nursing staff, caregivers that are hired for good or for ill, who come in. But really, there's no community of support around these people at all. And as you look at the makeup of Canada and you reflect on the trends over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, you see that more and more households are households of one, not just two. And that those who are families, an increasing number of them, almost a quarter of them, are led by single parents, an increasing number of whom are men. So if we are in those nations of one, and we have very little network of support, the story as it unfolds for George and Anne would even be a story of much deeper, richer resources than what many in our country will have access to themselves. The next question it asks, is asked in the difficult conversations is, who to blame? It's hard to blame anybody about this. It's just the way that life goes. It may be that in our fear and in our loss and in our anger at what happens, we're willing to point the finger at almost anything. But George and Anne don't do that. They don't get down to blaming someone for what's happening with Anne. Her surgery goes tragically wrong, but they are resigned to the realities that that offers them and live those realities out, difficult and challenging though it may be. It doesn't pay in that situation to point fingers and blame unless it's merely to get our anger out. And if that happens, great. But if we stay caught in that anger, constantly seeking to lay blame, constantly engaging the medical profession, constantly pointing fingers at someone who should have done something a little while before, we don't get to be in the moment to be with the one that we love as they're experiencing this challenging and traumatic time. So the who to blame question doesn't really fit into this, except to say that George and Anne rise above that process. They also rise above the intent, because of course there's no intent involved. But the next question is one that the authors of Difficult Conversations place before us, and it's reflected deeply in the movie, and that's the question about feelings. What are people feeling in this? It seemed, as I watched the movie and after it, I thought, there's almost no expression of feeling in the movie, which of course is not true at all. There's a depth of feeling that's shown, but much of it, I think, is feeling that's driven over by confusion, by disorientation, by the reality that the landscape in which these two people are is not one that they expected at all. And so the sense of loss and the anger and the fear and even the love is underneath the wheels of that bus of confusion and disorientation. The actors, Emmanuel Riva, at one point, and flips through a book of photographs. She expresses through her incredible acting all the different stages of loss of her faculties. She's a beautiful, bright, engaging person whose pupil has just played at this incredible piano concert when she begins the movie. And by the end of it, she is a moaning, indecipherable being, lying in bed, unable to care for herself. She follows that trajectory with incredible beauty, with incredible clarity. And if it doesn't make you afraid, I don't know what could. Because the process of that disintegration is huge, and brought to you in this manner, it's very, very real. The feelings that Georges displays are humor. He enjoys his wife. They have built this life together, which is one of incredible intimacy and joy. And as he goes through with Emmanuel, or with Anne, this process, he watches loss happen. He feels it deeply. He connects at one point with a pigeon, shooing it out of the apartment it has gotten itself into, and on another occasion engages with it in what seems to be almost a foreboding of what will happen at the end of the movie. But his feelings are complex and driven into the treadmarks of that bus of confusion. Our last question that Difficult Conversations asked us to look at is identity. Who are we if this is really happening the way we're seeing it happening? In our communications with one another, what does it mean if we accept what the other person is saying about us? And what does it mean if we own our story the way we're displaying it. The conversation that takes place in the movie is a conversation between two people, one of whom becomes increasingly unable to communicate. But there is a constant show of love. The two people are open and honest with one another. Ava maybe a little less so, because she appears as an intruder despite her status as a daughter. But the communication between George and Anne is open and honest, simple. It's not grand. It's hands very clear, very simply stated truths to one another. But the question, I think, that lingers beyond their own communication is, what does this kind of incapacity mean about who we are? And how does the way that we deal with it, how does that speak to who we are? And it's a question that I can't answer at this point. I don't know how I'm going to be in the face of incapacity, my own or Scott's or anyone else's. I know how I was with my dad, but that was related with my dad's relationship, with my relationship with someone else. I expect that it will be different. And we all will engage those relationships as they happen, if they happen to us, differently, based on the relationship that we've had and based on the love that we can muster. And one reviewer said, that's the title of the movie is really the direction about what to do in any of these situations. When we move through life with someone that we love, when we move through life with complex relationships all over the place, the only answer to how to do it and how to do it well is amour. It's love. It's to try to bring that to the fore in every situation. And then when we approach those final days of our own, then our identity can become that. When all that is left of me is love, then give me away. That's the process that is taking place in this movie. And it is incredibly and beautifully done. Last week, you voted on Argo and what you felt about the movie Argo, and whether on a scale of 1 to 10 you thought it was worth a 10 and the Oscar for Best Picture or not, by one of those fewer. I picked those votes up and did something with them. I have no idea where they are. So I'm going to invite you to vote on two movies today before you leave. Rip two pieces off your little piece of paper, write Argo on the top of one of them and Amour on the top of the other, and put your vote on those pieces of paper. And next week at the end of the service, when we're finished looking at our last movie, which is Life of Pi, which incidentally we're doing on West Hill's 63rd anniversary, we'll be able to tally them during coffee, and you'll be able to go into the show next Sunday night and know whether or not, and find out at the end of it whether or not you have chosen a winner. Amour offers us a gift, and it's one that we've been given many, many times before. The question is, how do we re-wrap it up? How do we re-gift it? How do we find ways to offer it to someone else? And how do we get so into that process that whenever we are offered that gift, we immediately repackage it, wrap it with our own strength, our own courage, our own hearts, and offer it again into the world? The cycle of love is a cycle that you see unfolding in Amour, and it is a beautiful gift. I hope you all have an opportunity to see it.